The pieces of the suspension order fluttered to the kitchen table like dead moths, each fragment bearing a fragment of the ministry's neat, impersonal cruelty. Administrative leave. Western associations. The words meant nothing and everything, words that could be rearranged into a confession if someone tried hard enough. Vera watched them settle among the sugar bowl and the chipped saucer her mother kept filling with things that weren't tea. She should have swept them away. Instead, she let them lie there, proof that the machine had noticed her, that the gears had ground past her name and found something worth stopping for. Her thumb throbbed. The scab had cracked again, fresh blood darkening the edges where the paper had bitten into her skin. She pressed her palm flat against the table, feeling the grain beneath her fingertips, the roughness of wood that had been sanded once and varnished twice and never quite smoothed. Everything in this apartment had been sanded once and varnished twice. Everything had been made to last longer than it should have lasted. "Elena," she said, and her mother looked up from the kitchen table where she had been counting packets of tea the way other women counted rosary beads. "Mama, I need to leave." Elena's spoon stopped midair. Tea dust clung to the porcelain like snow on a windowsill. She set it down very carefully, as though the act of setting it down might somehow contain whatever had just been said. "Leave." Her voice was small, the way it got when she was afraid and didn't want to show it. "Where? It's not safe. They've closed the stations. I heard it from Mrs. Kavar. Her son works at this. She said they're checking papers. They're checking everyone." "They're checking everyone," Vera agreed. She picked up a piece of the torn order and examined the ministry watermark, the way the paper fibers caught the light when you held it at an angle. She had always liked good paper. Good paper was honest. It didn't pretend to be something it wasn't. "That's exactly why I have to go now, before they close everything properly." Elena's hands were trembling. Vera noticed this because she had spent 26 years learning to read the small tremors in her mother's body, the way she used to read poems looking for the word that changed everything. The tremor in Elena's left hand meant fear. The tremor in both hands meant terror. Both hands were shaking. "You can't," Elena said, but it wasn't a refusal anymore. It was a plea. "Your father, when he was gone, I told myself you were safe here. Safe in this flat, safe in this city, safe in your work. You translate things. You make things understandable. That's not dangerous. That's just what you do." "No," Elena said, though the word lacked the force of a command. It had softened into something desperate. "When your father died, I convinced myself that you were protected here. Protected within these walls, within the city, within the safety of your labor." She spanned the distance between them, her hand enveloping Vera's uninjured one, squeezing until the pressure became a sharp, grounding pain. "I met with Mrs. Kavar last week. Her daughter used to translate French verse for the ministry. Merely verse. And now she has vanished. Not detained, simply erased. Her apartment is cordoned off with official seals. I tried to peer through the letterbox and the adhesive tore my skin." She lifted her right hand. A pale, jagged scar marked her index finger. "I share this not out of fear, but out of necessity. You must see the pattern. I am begging you to remain because I have watched what befalls those who handle foreign words, and the end is never grace." She turned from the window to the room's quiet decay. Below, the old town lay exposed in the thinning fog, the sloping roofs and chimney pots tracing the narrow alley that descended to the printer's shop on Karlova Ulis. Somewhere down there, the press would begin its mechanical grind at 4 o'clock. A relentless rhythm that ignored the arrests and the silence creeping through the city. Those hours, 4 o'clock and midnight, were the only anchors left, the only moments when time felt real rather than imposed by the new authorities who had already erased everything else. She needed a route. She needed a plan. And she needed someone who moved through the cracks in the system the way water moved through stone quietly, persistently, without drawing attention to itself. Lucas. The name surfaced from memory like a stone from the bottom of a river. She had met him 3 weeks ago, in the cafe after Jiri had handed her the satchel, after the warning about paper being heavier than lead. She had been sitting alone at the back table, trying not to think about the weight of what she was carrying, when a young man slid into the chair opposite her, without invitation. He was 22 at most, light brown hair falling into eyes that wouldn't settle on anything for more than a second. Twitchy, that was the first word that came to mind. Nervous. Speaking too fast, words tumbling over each other like children running through a doorway. "They'll come for the book eventually," he had said, and she hadn't known whether he meant the satchel or the manuscript inside it or something else entirely. Not the ministry. Not yet. But the ones who really care about these things, they're already looking. You need someone who knows the roots. The real roots, not the ones on the maps. She had told him she didn't need anything. She had told him she was just a translator. And he had looked at her with those wide, frightened eyes and said, "Everyone needs someone who knows the roots, even translators." Then he was gone, vanishing behind the cafe's fogged windows, and she had told herself she would never see him again. But she had remembered his face. She had remembered the urgency of his voice, rapid and clipped, as though every second might be his last. And she had remembered the address he pressed into her palm before he left. A street name, a number, a time. "Come to me if you need to disappear," he had said, and she had folded the slip of paper into her coat pocket and forgotten it until tonight. Now she unfolded it. The paper was soft from being handled, the ink slightly blurred at the edges where her sweat had touched it. "U Zilatejo Potoka 17, third floor, knock three times, wait for the light." Tonight, she unfolded it. The paper was soft from being handled, the ink slightly blurred at the edges where her sweat had touched it. "U Zilatejo Potoka 17, third floor, knock three times, wait for the light." She dressed quickly, pulling on her darkest coat and wrapping her scarf tightly around her neck. The apartment above the printer's shop felt different now, smaller, as though the walls were closing in to keep her from leaving. She paused at the door, her hand on the lock, and listened to her mother's breathing in the kitchen behind her. Steady. Controlled. The breathing of a woman pretending not to be afraid. "I'll be back before midnight," she said, and it was almost true. The stairwell smelled of wet ink and something older, and she descended three flights in the dark, her hand on the wall for balance, feeling the peeling wallpaper crumble beneath her fingertips. The printer below was already running, the familiar grinding sound rising through the floorboards like a prayer or a complaint. She didn't look down. She couldn't. If she looked down, she might remember the satchel waiting beneath the floor, and she might not be able to leave. Karlova Ulus was empty. The tanks were gone, or moved elsewhere, or parked in some courtyard three streets over where no one could see them. The street lamp still flickered at 6:47, though it was only 5 o'clock. Time was unraveling, thread by thread, and she was trying to weave something new from the loose ends. The address led her to a narrow street she had never noticed before, a lane tucked between two larger buildings like a secret the city had forgotten to share. U Zilatejo Potoka. At 17, the door was painted a color she couldn't name, brown or gray or something that had been one and had become the other through years of weather and neglect. She knocked three times. Waited. The light in the window above the door flickered on, yellow and uncertain, and she climbed the stairs. The third floor landing was narrow, lit by a single bulb that swung gently from its cord, casting shadows that moved like fish beneath water. A door stood at the end of the hall, slightly ajar, and the light from within spilled across the floorboards in a thin golden strip. She pushed it open. The room was small, a single room with a cot, a table, and a stove that smelled of coal. The walls were bare except for a single map of Czechoslovakia pinned to the plaster, its edges curling from humidity, its colors faded to ghostly pastels. And in the center of it all, standing by the table with his hands clasped in front of him like a schoolboy awaiting punishment, was Lukas. He turned when she entered, and his eyes widened not with surprise, but with something worse. Recognition. The recognition of a man who has been waiting for the thing he fears most to arrive, and who knows that arrival means the waiting is over and the consequences begin. "You came," he said, and his voice was exactly as she remembered, fast, thin, vibrating with the energy of someone who couldn't sit still even when standing. "I thought you didn't have to come. I thought maybe you'd decided to stay." "I've decided to leave," she said. She stepped inside and closed the door behind her. The room felt smaller with the door shut, the air thicker, as though the walls were breathing. "I need to get out of Prague, tonight." Lukas's fingers twisted the lapels of his threadbare coat, the wool thin against the November chill. She watched the tremor in his hands, counting the seconds until he spoke, needing the delay more than she needed the answer. "Tonight?" The word tasted foreign on his tongue, syllables he was still struggling to shape. "Tonight is impossible. The checkpoints have tightened. They've doubled the patrols on the western routes." Soldiers are boarding every train, tearing through luggage, checking papers, checking faces. He cut himself off, his gaze snapping to the map pinned to the wall before returning to hers. There is another way, but it is not simple. It is not safe. It is certainly not what you wish to hear. I don't want to hear safe, Vera said. I want to hear possible. He nodded quickly, almost violently, as though agreement were a physical motion he couldn't control. Carla Viveri, there's a train that leaves at midnight from the main station. It goes west Karlsbad, according to the Germans, according to the posters, but it doesn't stop there. It stops at a junction near the border, and from there, he stopped again. His hands were shaking. From there, there's a route, through the woods, along the railway line. It takes most of the night, but if you move quietly, if you avoid the main roads, it's possible. I've done it. Twice. Twice, she said, the word hung in the air between them. Twice. Two successful crossings. Two proofs that the impossible was merely difficult. You've crossed the border. Yes, he said it quickly, defensively, as though admitting it were a crime. But the route has changed. The soldiers, they know about the old paths now. They've set up new checkpoints near the border. Floodlights, dogs. The whole, he gestured vaguely toward the window, toward the city beyond, toward the world that was closing around them like a fist. So the train gets you to the junction. And from there, I can meet you. I can guide you the rest of the way, but you have to be ready to move fast. You have to leave everything behind. The satchel, the papers, anything that connects you to this place. Especially the satchel, but you have to be ready to move. She felt the floor tilt beneath her feet, just slightly, the way a ship tilts when it crosses from calm water into a current. He knew about the satchel. Of course he knew. He was a courier. Knowing about the things people carried was his job, his trade, his entire reason for existing in the spaces between the official routes and the real ones. How do you know about the satchel? She asked, and her voice was steadier than she felt. Lucas looked down at the table, at his hands, at anything but her face. Jiri told me, he said quietly. He paid me to watch you, not to follow you to watch in case you needed help. He said you were the kind of person who would try to carry everything and drown because of it. A pause. He wasn't wrong. Vera closed her eyes. Jiri. Always Jiri, stepping into her life like a shadow that had forgotten to stay in place. She had trusted him enough to give him the satchel, and he had trusted her enough to send someone to watch over her, and somewhere in the middle of that trust was a line she hadn't known existed until now. What do you need from me? She asked. For the train, for the route, for whatever comes after. Lucas looked up, and for the first time his eyes were steady. I need you to be brave, he said. Not heroic. Not brave like the men who stayed and fought and got shot in the streets. Just brave enough to walk out that door and not look back. The train leaves at midnight. I'll be at the station. I'll find you. You don't need to speak to me, you just need to be there. And when we reach the junction, you'll follow me. You won't ask questions. You won't stop. And you certainly won't look back. Her mind drifted to the kitchen, where her mother counted tea packets to steady her shaking hands. Beneath the floorboards, the satchel lay silent, a heavy weight of paper and peril that Vera was still unsure whether to salvage or destroy. Above her, on the fourth floor of the ministry, Colonel Hansel stood by the window. His gaze had not been one of anger, but of a cold, calculating pity that lingered longer than hatred. 4 o'clock, midnight, these were the only times that still mattered. I'll be at the station, she said. Lucas nodded. He reached into his coat pocket and produced a small bundle of wrapped paper-strain tickets, she realized, stamped with dates and destinations and the ministry's approval, the kind of documents that existed in a world that no longer existed. He placed them on the table beside the map. Midnight, he said again, and this time his voice was different, quieter, steadier, the voice of a man who had made a decision and was no longer afraid of the consequences. Don't be late. She left the way she had come down the swinging staircase, through the narrow street, past the flickering lamp that marked the boundary between the street she knew and the one she didn't. The fog had returned, thicker now, wrapping around her shoulders like a blanket she hadn't asked for. She walked fast, faster than she usually walked, because speed was a form of courage, and courage was the only currency she had left. The apartment was dark when she entered. Her mother's chair was empty, the tea packets still arranged in neat rows on the table. Vera stood in the center of the room for a moment, listening to the printer below grind through its afternoon routine, unaware that the world above it was preparing to tear itself apart. She went to the bedroom, knelt beside the floorboard, and lifted it. The satchel was exactly where she had left it, leather worn soft by touch, contents wrapped in oilcloth, the weight of it pressing into her palms like a question she couldn't answer. She held it for a long time, feeling the paper inside shift slightly, as though the pages were breathing, as though the words on them were waiting for her to decide what to do with them. Then she set it down. She closed the floorboard. She walked back to the kitchen and picked up the bundle of train tickets from the table and slipped them into her coat pocket. Midnight, the train to Carlovivere. The junction, the woods, the border at Cheb with its floodlights and its dogs and its soldiers who smelled of diesel and rain. She would be there. She would follow Luca's. She would not look back. The radiator hissed. The printer below had stopped. The city exhaled. Vera withdrew her hand, leaving the splintered wood to keep it secret, and let the silence settle back into the room like a heavy blanket.